ты как тут прячешься, ничего. Это Дранан. Сидней said, what? You don't think that Nozick is a genius?
And did he say this?
It's deliberate. Oh, ironically. Nozick is believes the exact opposite of what he believes. The reactionary, deep, conservative reaction. Nozick, you don't think? Nozick is as great a genius as Hobbes. And really? Who haven't heard of Nozick? Bit of that occurs. I believe it. I think there are no dominant political theorists in the 20th century who are equal to the sort of great classics. Middle.
Or
mid. Yes, or even, wait a minute, let's go to that later. Weber is not quite a political thinker, but of that category, yes. You see? Marx, Weber.
I don't think we have ever... We had the opportunity to discuss Tocqueville.
Tocqueville did come up in these discussions.
Indeed.
Yes.
But not in ours, yes.
Well, I never studied Tocqueville. I never taught it. And I never had few thoughts, so I read it. It's a very brilliant kind of political, not sociology, but analysis of what happens. You can say that partly historical, partly political, but ultimately it's a very high form of publicism. Like Isaac Hudson. It's like observation, yes. Description of America, it's a description. The idea that equality is advancing on us anyway. It's more like, who should we say, Burkhardt, like Carlyle. That's what it is, relates to.
And was the argument yesterday about it? I mean, did my friends push names? I mean,
No. No, no. I didn't know that Tocqueville would be very useful to Israelis in that school. Certainly not the... When the trouble was, what about the French Revolution? Who has written, what should one read?
From the thinkers.
Anything. How does one bring the French Revolution to their consciousness? And the Canadians, what about Carlyle? Because there is nothing but rhetorical poetry of a certain kind. No, in that case, I said, Nietzsche was better. Who is a straight historian, describes events from point of view, but still, nobody is neutral about the French Revolution. There's a lot of annal stuff, but isolated monographs. But if one had to read about the French Revolution, what would one read?
I like Thompson.
I think that's the best. It's dull and decent. Perfect, all right. Tells you what happened. I made Ali read it. Thompson's book, he was done in Magdalen. Old clergyman, yes. Old hung frock clergyman in Magdalen. It's a straightforward, impartial book. It tells you how it was. After that, you can think what you like.
I'm not up to date.
No, he wasn't either.
But in my day, it
nor
was
Mr.
Thompson.
So did I. But I didn't know what it is now.
Yes, I don't know.
Maybe there is something else.
There are older, plenty.
Not me, I know. But it's all either pro Robespierre, or pro Danton, or pro Tocqueville, or pro something else. Straight narrative, history of French Revolution, doesn't really exist.
But one ought, of course, to have a book on it, because...
Well, what about the Russian Revolution? They said again that nothing exists because the documents aren't there.
Coming here from on, so the French Revolution, it's not only its impact, even the terminology...
No, but they said thoughts about the French Revolution, the reaction to it. There's not much about that either. There are books. They're not exactly first rate. There are books about German reaction, books about the English reaction. Such things exist. They're not classical books to be put in the 100. They should read it. You can't force them.
Yes. Well, in one way, the French Revolution is more important than the Russian Revolution.
Of course.
I mean, modern terminology comes from them.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Left and right.
Of course, of course. Of course.
Marx used the terminology of the French Revolution.
Well, of course. The left and right is recurrent. No, the French Revolution turned everything over. Upset everything. Left nothing standing. Nobody was... The French Revolution made it impossible to read people who read before it. Take them as serious. I mean, Gibbon, all right, on the ancient world. But otherwise, all these stories became, somehow, the whole thing changed. The question changed, the answer changed.
Now, in the British Academy, do you remember any issue that...
No. Nothing. Expressive.
I remember one, but it's not the one on Blunt.
Yes, of course. I can tell you what part I played in that.
You were the president then?
No, thank God. I had gone mad. It was a year after I stopped being. I was asked to go on for another year. I was just wise enough to stop. I think it would have driven me off my head. What happened was that, of course, the Plum, who I'm sure was a communist once upon a time, led the agitation against Blunt. He wrote a letter to the president saying he must be expelled. Well, I was not in the council. The president, fortunately, is not even on the council. He has no position. He just lapses into the ordinary ranks. And I had a certain amount of argument in the press, and I had a letter from the secretary, Carswell, who said, "Can you help? The council is divided. If we can go forward like that, the Academy will tear itself to pieces. We need something for a vote. We're bound to vote on this. And council will make a recommendation for or against anyhow. And that'll have to be debated. There are people who are strongly for, there are people who are strongly against expulsion. But there is a middle block who don't know what to think. Can you produce a promotion which will, so to speak, be something which a large majority could vote for, whichever direction. So that we don't have a total collision and a permanent division of the Academy for all time. Suez, Munich, they didn't want it. Well, all right, I understood that. So I meditated and secretly I generated this motion. The motion said, while the Academy deplores the behavior of Sir Anthony Blunt, he does not wish to proceed further in the matter. Now, this will be against people who want him expelled. But the fact we deplore would suit the people who want something, not nothing. People wanted to keep him, wanted nothing at all. It's not the business of academies to condemn people for political crimes. If there's a political crime, it's with police. Nothing to do with us. It's a perfectly possible position. Herbert Hart took exactly that position. Exactly that. Southern and Bedo took up that position. Now, the man who was going to propose a motion that he be expelled. Because they had a majority of one. Maybe of two. The question was, who was going to oppose the motion? The man who chose to oppose the motion was Lord Robbins. He was a great friend of Blunt. When he discovered Blunt had done that the blackest day in his entire life, he couldn't come to terms with it. But he'd be with him on the Courtauld, and he was there at the National Gallery. They knew each other very well. And he had great regard. He was a simple, naive, sweet man, Rovins. Very nice man, very honorable, rather simple, but morally of very good character. And politically, sort of the super liberal of all time. There's never been liberal like him. The real absolute quintessence of liberal tradition. So he was going to oppose it. On what grounds, I don't know. He didn't tell me. He asked me to second it. I declined. On two grounds. One bad, one good. The bad ground was not too bad, but was that I didn't, as I was an ex-president, and he was an ex-president, it looked as if the House of Lords, somebody from the body of the Academy should be the second, and there shouldn't be two presidents. That was a bad reason. The good reason was this. You see, somehow Herbert Hart took the line that no matter what the fellow of the Academy did, unless we elect them entirely on intellectual grounds, unless it is an intellectual crime, I mean, I don't know, cheating, yeah, forgery, there was no case for the Academy to proceed. That is for them. I felt that I didn't quite agree with it. That if somebody asked me, would there be no situation in which you would vote against for expulsion? I would think, supposing we had fellow or would-be fellow, or corresponding fellow abroad, who was the greatest authority in Portuguese art who ever existed, who was a man of popular genius, could never be forgotten, a man of the highest possible talent in the matter, immortal. But one knew that on Thursday mornings he was the head of a concentration camp and gouged out the eyes of little children every Thursday morning. Would I then vote for the expulsion of men? I would. So the question is, where does one draw the line? One can't say where one draws the line. There's no principle. One draws the line where one draws the line. It's a ultimately subjective matter. It can't be avoided. Something which completely crosses everything one believes and wants in the world. And something one can't tolerate. At all. At any price. If somebody challenged me, I wouldn't be able to answer properly. Therefore, I would rather that whoever seconded Robbins was in the position of those who said nothing should stand in the way. You see no way of removing him for anything he did, unless you think he's intellectually inadequate. So I didn't. But I didn't feel strongly. I was for keeping him. Why, I wasn't sure myself. And funnily enough, Trevor Roper was for keeping him, for which I give him great credit. It meant that intellectual merit for him outweighed. Blake was against. They were friends, but they obviously disagreed very strongly. Plum was pursued him ferociously.
Now, the wording, well, there was Plum's motion.
It was a council motion. Council motion.
Council motion. And what was the wording of Robin's motion?
I mean, my thing.
Yours.
It was supplied to him, and he accepted it. I don't think he knew that I'd drafted it, but the secretary said, we've got the following draft of a motion. Would you like, that's what council put forward. Council put forward that this is the motion, which they oppose, which the others can support. The motion is that it proceeds no further. Council is against it. They didn't want to say expel, because why? That would mean they would have to have treason and so on. They didn't want to do all that.
And I mean, the majority was against expulsion.
Vast, great majority. No, well, then what happened after the speeches were made? The vice chancellor, the poor old secretary had to buy tiddlywinks, little thing, little green and lead spheres, because there was no secret ballot in the entire history of the academy. And founded in 1902, I think, or some such time. You see, there's no case, the only case would have been some intellectual blood. They never thought there'd be a political issue. Couldn't be cross concentrated. So he had to buy a box and little pebbles and God knows what. And this man got up and said, "Mr. President, I have a entirely procedural motion," his lawyer, "to offer, which will not need a secret ballot. Because procedural motions, you have an open ballot. And may I put it here, sir? My motion is that we proceed to the next item on the agenda." Procedural motion. We voted openly. And something like 75 people voted to proceed, and 35 people voted, 40 people voted against. That was it.
Well,
rather brilliant move.
Pardon?
Rather brilliant move.
And so, but you know, I mean, you know what people said. Otherwise, it was a secret ballot.
No, there's no secret ballot.
But you said that it was the first time that you had.
But it wasn't used. The man got up, produced the motion, no secret ballot, came to the same. So people had to vote openly.
So you know how everybody voted, more or less.
Well, like I said, unfortunately, as always, I think I came late, so I had to sit in the front row, which was always empty, until the British meetings. So I couldn't look back. So I just can't tell you exactly. I long to know.
And during elections in Oxford, in the university, in colleges...
Well, I wasn't torn like this. I wasn't morally torn. It didn't upset me. I was all excited. It was an interesting business. What had happened?
In the Blunt
affair. I knew which side I was on. That's all. I didn't make propaganda.
And were there any elections in which you were active in the university, in the college? Well, there are many ways of being active.
Plenty of elections.
Signatures you gave to candidates.
Yes.
Nearly everything.
Candidates of what?
I mean, let's say when Jenkins and he...
Yes.
You support Jenkins?
Yes.
And beforehand when Macmillan and...
I voted. I did not support anybody, because Frank is a great friend, but I proposed to vote Macmillan. Because I thought that no Don ought to be Chancellor. I still think that it's Dalai Lama position. It's entirely, it has no power. It's entirely, as it were, what is the word I'm looking for?
Ceremonial?
Yes. You see, I thought it ought not to be somebody who might meet at the 9 o'clock in the morning train, Oxford platform. It ought to be some eminent person outside, who, so to speak, sort of symbolic position. Anyway, I like Macmillan anyway. And so I thought he would do it beautifully, and did. Mm-hmm. Very good speeches, and did it beautifully. He did not want Blunt's honorary degree to be taken away from Oxford. Nor was it. Blunt? An honorary doctor. So it was idiotic to remove it. Idiotic. He's very liberal, Macmillan. Civilized man. Whereas Frank's is rather stiff sort of years.
Now, coming back to Wolfson. I know that there is an article in the Wurzel magazine, Lycidas, or how is it called?
Yes.
About the origins of Wurzel College or the...
Yes.
But, I haven't read it. But it's not, the article is not personal. I mean, what really made you accept?
I don't know. I received a letter from the vice chancellor of the WEA when I was at Princeton. And I showed it to Eileen. I'd been professor of political theory for almost, not quite 10 years. I think I was elected in 57. And I wanted the job because I wanted a discipline to make me do some work. If I have no discipline, I don't do any work, like now. And so I wanted a straitjacket. I wanted something to force me to lecture twice a week. And if I wanted to write, I would write. But I didn't want to be a research fellow to torment myself. Was I doing enough? That is my sole motive. For one day, I applied for the job. I wasn't invited. I applied for it like any other, like anybody else. Now, I'd done it for about 9 years, and I felt that I didn't really enjoy it very much, because I didn't have sufficiently strong interest in what is right and wrong, what is good and bad, politically, that's to say, in actual issues. I was fascinated by the ideas of the past. I loved the ideas, I loved the history of the subject, I loved the, so to speak, entire world of political ideas. But I felt the professor ought to be somebody with some kind of opinions too, which you could rationally defend. And ought to be deeply concerned about the burning issues of the day. I was not. And that was why, in a way, I was glad to, and I thought, well, quite nice to do something else. Nothing, I had no idea. I realized that it was possibly a lot of absurd, but I didn't say no. I came back to Oxford and talked to these people. I found them very nice people. Ooh. The people were then Iffley College. You see, you don't know how it came about. How was the whole story? You see, when I... No, that isn't it. In the old days, there were fellows of colleges and not fellows. Yes. There still are. So first-class citizens, second-class citizens. First-class citizens were usually people who taught the popular undergraduate subjects. Classics, history. Chaplin was a fellow, usually. Not always. Mother languages, not always. Not many people did it. Russian, certainly not. Science, we never saw them, they worked in laboratories. Professors had to be, because they automatically carry the fellowship. Readership does not. So, in the old days, there were two people. There were fellows and non-fellows. The non-fellows gradually became discontented. And they found a leader in Michael van Heningen, who was a pathologist in Florid Laboratory, and he got elected to congregation, to council. It meant the revolt of the parias. 19 began in the early 1950s. Late 40s maybe. They threatened whatever was like the Irish Party. Either they would go to America, or they would block legislation in the congregation. Gradually, they suddenly felt, and there were fellows of the Royal Society who never made fellows of college, like Zuckerman, never became fellow of anyone. He was never less, others in the same position. You see? He led these people. This scientist led many of the scientists. He has gone.
No. I'll ask later. All right.
Well, once he became elected, he became a member of council. The university became frightened. They thought it would be serious consequences. Maybe it would be a kind of mass exodus. Even before this came up, there was already a movement headed by the Warden of Merton, with a very nice ancient historian called Harrison, to try and persuade colleges to expand their fellowship.
Even in
your thing, that is before it became an issue. Some colleges took, we took one or two people, colleges, but not very many. It still left about 300 people unprovided for. Because the university can appoint without the colleges giving them fellowships, or even lectureships, or even membership of the common room. Colleges are independent sovereign bodies. Then, the university, in a state of perturbation, passed a statute. The statute said that anybody with more than some X number of years, certain categories of people, who had held the post for more than a certain number of years, were entitled to a fellowship. Entitled. But no college was obliged to give them one. So it was an absurd law in a way. I mean, it created a moral responsibility. In other words, give them a passport, but no visa. Anybody could have made a fellow. But these people had entitlement, which meant that there was a case for making the fellows. No college was obliged to. Colleges behaved exactly like countries under threat of immigration. No room at the high table. Scientists don't come to college much. They don't do anything about undergraduates. Persian is not a subject which is taught here. There's not enough rooms. It costs too much. God knows what it is. There was a thing called something of colleges now. The thing which Frank's commission set up. Media of colleges, or whatever it is.
Yes, I mean, like Dean was and...
No. All heads of colleges come together. Uh-huh. At a formal meeting. Twice a term. To discuss matters of common interest.
Ah, that was it.
Entirely. Forgotten what its official name is. Something of colleges.
I know.
Not meeting. Something. Conference of colleges. It's called. Conference of colleges. There this issue was thrashed out. I mean, do we have to take them? Are we obliged? What do we reply to? And so on. It arose out of the Franks Commission, this movement. Then, in order to solve the problem, they said to us, what is the college? College is simply a meeting of people who recognize each other as colleagues. It doesn't say the college has no building. It doesn't say the college has no money. It's a club. People meet, dining club. Still, they were given buildings. The two colleges were created. One was called Ifri, that was called St. Cross. Ifri was given a building in Ifri. Old 18th century building, which I think is probably falling down some ways. Very handsome, rather 3 miles from Oxford. Ifri, St. Cross was given the St. Cross Rectory, the St. Cross Road. I think the entitled people then simply chose some one college, some the other. The only thing was the head of the college was going to give some money. The president was going to get salary. Nobody else was. They all had university posts, so they were paid for. That was the theory. But since the president might be outsider, he would have to be remunerated. Well, the first man, St. Cross, chose the leader, the man who led the revolution, Van Heiningen, South African pathologist. He lived without a head, and they went first of all to, he was a famous mathematical chemist in Wadham. Very famous scientist, considerable. He said he would if he was given £2 million. so as to create a building and have graduate students. College is a college, or the university. Neither could nor would to that. So then he withdrew after acrimonious. They then sent me a letter. It is weird. It. I didn't tell it on because I thought it might be fun. I don't know. I just didn't know what it entailed. I came back to Oxford. I interviewed representatives of Vivley College, and I said, the university has perpetrated a fraud on you. They've made you fellows. You're a college, but you're not a college. You have no money. They were given £20,000. And the rich colleges gave them, I think, £10,000 for 8 years. Not money. Even by the standards of 60. So I said, it's really, unless you get, he said, look, I agree, how do we get money? I said, I don't know. Can you help us? Yes. I'll do my best. That's how it began. The rest of the story I tell in the thing, you'll see it.
But earlier you said that you applied and you are not opposed.
For a chair. I applied my chair, not Hifley.
You applied for
my professorship.
I asked about...
No. Oh, no. Uh-huh. No, they selected me.
That's it?
No. They thought I'd bring the money. That's what I did.
Why did you accept? You didn't tell me.
I tell you, I don't know why. I still don't. I thought it might be amusing, interesting, to create a new college. See what it is, you see? You see, what happened was that unless I collect the money, I wasn't going to take it. I did not accept until the money was in the bag. I refused to be elected, because I thought if there was no money, then I wouldn't accept. There's no point. They didn't need a visit. They were at a college. St. Cross was a rather meaningless institution.
So Wolfson grew out of Ifley.
Ifley was Wolfson.
And that explains why there are so many scientists in Wolfson.
Entirely. And I made use of that. My whole application to Ford was the ground that it would become a base for scientists.
Now, when you earlier said that you applied and you were not happy, you were not happy with the chair, or you were not happy in Wolfson?
I wasn't happy, and unhappy with either. But I got a bit bored of the chair.
In the chair. But in the college, you were not
happy. I was entirely happy from the first moment to the last. The only motion I ever opposed at one of these general meetings, was that children under 12 should be allowed to come to the common room and eat the meal without an adult. That I thought was going a little too far.
Now, when you were approached, you showed the letter to Aline. Did you consult with any other friend?
No. I only consulted when I was offered Nuffield. I was offered there too. In 1953, I think. I was pre-elected by the fellows of Nuffield. I was offered it by them. And I consulted absolutely everybody. Mm-hmm. And then refused.
Now,
everybody told me to take it.
Ah.
Everybody.
And then you refused?
Well, I think Sparrow perhaps told me, if I wanted to be near the station, the governor of the jail was just as good.
I was going to ask, when do you consult and when you don't consult?
I consult always. In the case of Ifley, I didn't have to consult, it was very clear. I mean, I decided to not do it. There was nothing to tell. Nobody knew what it would become. Nobody had any idea. It's a shot in the total dark. Nuffield was an existing institution. They already had three wardens they had. You see, quite an eminent kind. Why they chose me, I don't know. to this day don't know. But I thought, no, economics and political science, not my thing. I couldn't bear it. It was too narrow.
And whenever you consult, I mean, when do you take advice? And
I remember consulting in when I was at Harvard at the time. Yeah. That came up. Nuffield came up. I was at Harvard, 1953 or so. And I was rather excited to say, only offer in the common market, open market, was ever made to me. Every other job I applied for. In all my life.
Really?
Yes. Mm-hmm. I don't think I was ever took a job. I was ever offered a job in the open market. No. I don't think so. This is the first one, which I didn't. I had no idea what was going to happen. I was what's called a faculty fellow in the field. Well, doesn't matter who that was. Anyhow. And then I was rather excited. I thought maybe. They're very rich, they're very well endowed, just that. I didn't mind it. I used to go to my college meetings. The building I thought was rather ugly, but I'm not very visually affected. But then I did consult. I remember at Harvard meeting Szilard. That's who I knew. He said, oh, I would certainly take it. Now you go to Lord Nuffield and say, I'll turn out that bunch of reds. We'll give you as much money as you like. That's very typical. I still did not decide not to take it when I came back. I still wondered, yes, no, no, yes.
And the majority of your friends told you to take it.
The vast majority. You can change it, you can alter it, you can do what you like. No, when I thought who the fellows were, no, I didn't see what I could do with it. It would have to be economics and political science to dedicate to social sciences. Maybe I could infiltrate a few historians. But the majority would do subjects with which I had no sympathy, or of which I had no understanding. That seemed to be absurd.
Now, when you are faced with such decisions, whose judgment do you trust?
Nobody.
Supervise to take it more seriously than the others, if there is.
I would take my wife's advice very seriously, very good. She's very thoughtful. And when she gives a piece of advice, it's thought out. It's not impulsive. And when she says something, it usually makes sense. It has a certain aesthetical moral quality, which I understand very well. My father was dying in 53. I told him that I'd offered it. He said, no, no. On his deathbed, no, not that kind of quality.
Really?
When he was at Oxford during the war. And for some reason he knew. I wouldn't think he would know. But in some way he felt it wasn't. There were colleges and colleges, but purely snobbish grounds. So it wasn't quite real. I think they chose me because they wanted to be a college. Because at that time, they thought St. Anthony's was. Because they drank port, they sat around the table somehow. With Bill Deakin, it had a real Oxford quality. Whereas they were like something in Sheffield, the refectory table, or something provincial. Something like LSE. It somehow wasn't like somehow external to Oxford, which is true, still is.
I know.
In the way that St. Anthony's is not. That is peculiar, but it's different. It has a certain Oxford quality, certain, also not very intrinsic. Oh, that's my name.